Ariane et Amadou,
bonjour, ça va bien? Comment allez-vous?
Good evening. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 here in Portland, Oregon. Now it is time for the Bread and Roses show. It is Friday evening at 6 p.m. and every week the Bread and Roses show comes to you from the Bread and Roses Collective at 6 p.m. This evening, my name's Marlise, by the way, and this evening we're joined with by two women. One is Chris Holloway, and she is in Massachusetts. Chris, are you there?
I'm here. Hello, Marlise.
Hi there. Welcome.
Thank you.
From afar.
Thank you.
I'm going to turn you up here, Chris. And also, Kimberly Suriano, who is a doctor here, OBGYN in Portland. She's works at Emmanuel, right, Kim?
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, Kim.
Thank you.
And you and Chris didn't get a chance to really talk on the phone before the show, so I would like to introduce you two as well.
Thanks.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, Chris. You know, I really, really loved your book. In fact, it was interesting because when you were introduction, saying how you got your letter in June of 1989 and were taken off from Mali, I, too, was your same age and that same month and same year, leaving for Guatemala, so we had very similar experiences. So it was really rich for me to read what you had gone through, and I was definitely relating to a lot of what you were talking about.
I'm glad. I look forward to talking to you about it on the show.
Yeah.
So perhaps you two could start a little bit, and maybe Chris, you could go first and tell us what you do and a little bit about yourself, and then we'll let Kim kind of talk about herself a little bit, and then we'll talk about your book, Monique and the Mango Rains.
Well, I live out here in Northampton, Massachusetts, and work in writing and development for not-for-profit organizations out here. I currently work for the National Priorities Project, which is an economic and social justice organization based here in Northampton. And I've been working on researching and writing this book for way longer than I want to admit, but I will admit it, starting in 1999. And I have two children. I met my husband, John, in the Peace Corps, and we have two boys, 12 and 9.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Welcome. Welcome
Thank
to Portland.
You.
And you've been out here before a couple of times, right?
Yeah, I've got family in Portland. My father's parents were out there, and my aunt Jackie and cousin Michael. So we try to get out to that part of the world as much as we can.
Nice. And Kimberly, you are here in Portland.
Yeah, I've been here 4 years now, and I work for a practice called Every Woman's Health, and the name is really our philosophy. We try to see all women, and I'm really fortunate to do what I do, and I get to deliver babies and sort of take care of women throughout their life cycle. So, and I'm just here locally, and I just practice at one hospital.
And you have?
And I'm a mother as well. I have a daughter, Allegra, who's 9, and Azura, who's 4.
Monique, It was such a wonderful opportunity. I was handed your book from Kate, who is also here at KBOO, and she said, oh my goodness, you have got to read this book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was perfect. I mean, the timing was perfect for me and what I was ready to read. You know how sometimes you get those books and, I'm not quite ready for that. But it really was perfect. And, of course, I talked to Kim about, oh my goodness, you've got to read this book. So it's so wonderful to have the opportunity to read the book. It's called Monique and the Mango Rains, and it's about your friendship 2 years with a midwife in Mali, actually beginning with 2 years and then going much, much longer. What inspired you to write the book?
Well, I always thought that I should write a book about Monique, this West African midwife in Mali, because she was such an example of an ordinary woman, a sixth grade education, three children at 24, was the sole midwife for this village of 1,400 people. An ordinary woman doing absolutely extraordinary things. But it wasn't until, and I always had that idea, but it wasn't until 1999 when we went back to Mali that I really knew that I had to tell her story.
And you went back under not at all, under sad circumstances.
Yes. I mean, I worked with her from 1989 to 1991, and then she came to the States in 1992 mm-hmm. for a month and got to visit here and do some talks. And then we stayed in touch for many years, and I, like Kimberly, was very inspired by working in women's health and got my master's in public health and had my children with midwives. And then, unfortunately, she died in childbirth herself in 1998 with her fifth baby, a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very sad.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, well, we went back to not only mourn her death, but, I was sort of, I was ready to sue somebody, from that American perspective of mm-hmm. how in the world could this happen to her, this fabulous woman, how could she die, from this fate that she had saved so many other women from. So I left a tape recorder running. My husband John and I went back for 2 weeks and interviewed the midwife and her family and friends and the village women and the village chief to try to figure out what happened. And what I realized is that this book was so much more about her life than her death, mm-hmm. I'm happy to say.
Mm-hmm. And so you came back with a lot of questions, and we can go into that in a little bit.
Mm.
Kim?
Well, I was just wondering, I would love to focus on her life, but what do you think you learned about her, specifically her death and sort of death from her cultural perspective?
Well, it was interesting because I think what I learned was the number of things that need to be in place to have a healthy birth. And it, of course, is in cases of emergency having that tertiary care. I had my children at home with midwives, and I was, 10 minutes from the University of Michigan Hospital. Mm-hmm. So if something went wrong, mm-hmm. I knew I had the best care in the world available to me. So that wasn't available to her. And she also really wasn't in control of the decisions in her life. She was pregnant and she didn't want to be. She was overworked. She didn't have the transportation to the place she needed to get to. So in my mind, I've kind of thought about it from sort of a human rights perspective. And I'd love to talk to you more, Kim, about what you've seen in your work. And then I think the other added piece to that was when I listened through my, feminist Western lens mm-hmm. to her family stories, mm-hmm. they were much more about reading meaning into the events leading up to her death, about the miraculous rains that came at mm-hmm. a time of year when they normally didn't come, and that seeing those rains and these signs that they felt Monique was showing them in the months preceding her death, allowed them to be at peace with what happened because it somehow was part of a bigger picture.
And also that she passed the baton on to other people, other women in the village, and she empowered so many people while she was alive.
Absolutely. She empowered so many women, and her sister has become a midwife now because she was inspired by Monique's example, and her cousin is has started and is expanding a clinic in her honor, and proceeds, some of the proceeds of my royalties go to fund that clinic. So we're all trying as best we can to carry on this legacy. But I'd love to know, Kim, from you, have you, I mean, you've read the book, is the stories of women there in Mali, did that somewhat mirror what your experiences have been?
Well, you mean in the States? Or just in general?
You could speak to the States or in your work. Is it in Guatemala?
Yeah, Guatemala, and then just a little bit of time in Africa and Mexico. You know, because you're right. In outside of the States, the resources and the care is different. And like you said, in terms of emergency care, depending how far you're out from that, I haven't. I've usually worked in more of a hospital setting, but I was in Guatemala. There was not even a Monique in the village, so you know, there was, unfortunately, they didn't have anyone. So that was sort of like one end of the spectrum, and then now I'm kind of at the other end of the spectrum where I'm in a hospital that's fully equipped, if you will. There's a physician on the unit 24 hours a day for any emergency, and a whole, you know, neonatal, the best neonatal intensive care unit right next door in case anything was unexpectedly happen. And that's just the thing. And I mean, in terms of childbearing, it can go so well most of the time, and yet Mother Nature's just can be unpredictable. And under even the best of circumstances, some things just take a turn. And, you know, I think that I like that feeling that if I need to, I have the tools to kind of deal with that and then try to keep it as natural as I can and not use, you know, that those ancillary or tertiary services if I don't need to, you know?
Yeah.
So that's how I try to keep that balance. But...
And I also, it was interesting, Chris and Kim, that Monique was the doctor, not only the midwife, but she also was the doctor for everything. Is that right?
Well, she was, the village health care worker. Mm-hmm. So the person who was there to take care, do any kind of health education around diarrhea or weighing of babies or talking about vaccinations as well as dispensing medications, vitamins, anti-malarial drugs, doing any kind of little minor surgeries. I think sub-Saharan Africa, from the reading I've done, has the lowest number of doctors and nurses per capita of anywhere in the world.
I was going to ask you.
It wasn't a unique situation that she was in.
Yeah, you know, I struggle because, you know, we are in this Western society and all this intervention, and, you know, you look at the C-section rates, and, you know, like a patient comes in and asks me, what's your C-section rate? And it's sort of like, you know, I like to think my C-section rate is appropriate because I'm going to save your baby if I need to, you know, and you never know. You don't want to, like, have a set number kind of thing. But then, and then I'm always, I just kind of practice with always wanting to do less intervention. And then I went to Malawi and, you know, saw what happens when you don't, you know, again was revisited with what you don't have that option. I remember this woman coming in who was in, you know, with a kind of a health nurse laboring, and then the hand came out, and then of course I got her when the baby was blue and she completely ruptured through the uterus, and then I was able to do a surgery to save the mom. But then you're like, you know, there's, again, it's, I think you tried to bring it up in the book, what's that happy medium with childbearing? And, you know, it's probably, we don't want to be on an extreme side of either side of that pendulum.
Yeah, I think that's really the crux of the issue. Like, you know, how do we find that happy medium between this, you know, beautiful, I mean, in Mali, it was such a beautiful community-centered event, you know? I mean, we don't have our entire village singing birth songs when we give birth. Now, wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
You know, and to have all these women at our side that we've known for a decade or more. So there's, it feels like there's so much that's gained through a woman, you know, having a more of a community-centered and community-honored birth. And then again, you certainly don't want women and children dying in childbirth and labor either. So it does feel like we've maybe lost a little bit of the community-centered parts of birth here. And I always think, you know, when I had my home births, I was a little righteous about it at first, you know. And then realized, you know, it's real. I did my master's thesis on women in Detroit, especially Medicaid women, and what were the kind of choices that they had in terms of where they gave birth, and realized that it really does come down to choice. Where does a woman feel safe?
Yes.
What does she want to have happen to her body? Is she educated about what her options are? And that seemed to be the real... I don't know. That seemed to be like, if every woman could really have someone talk to her about those choices, it would make a world of difference.
And where she feels right with it. That's so important.
I have a good friend of mine. Her first name is Karen, and she doesn't like pain. You know, and she wants a scheduled C-section.
Right.
You know, just boom, give me that baby. I don't want to deal with it. And, you know, I've come around to, even though that's not the choice I would make.
Right.
You know, it's like, would that every woman felt so empowered with whatever choice it was that they were making. So I've cooled my jets a little bit, but I mean, it sounds like, Kimberly, you've really sort of taken that midwifery model of working with women to the greatest extent you can and allowing them to have that control and watch what their bodies will do, and yet you've got the tools to step in if need be.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too, though, when I think of, you know, the difference with Kim, you have also a medical support system. Imagine Monique, who is in the village, and she is the... Now, I wonder, when the community gathers around and around the birth, do they also, you know, if do they also, you know, what happens if the baby is dead, or if something doesn't, you know, is wrong? I mean, do they see it as wrong, or is that something that it's supposed to happen? You know, how is that different here? Of course, we look at, we're going to sue, and it goes back to the doctor. I mean, how does the responsibility surround the birth?
Well, you know, I don't want to make a generalized statement just because I sort of really only know this one family and this one place in Mali well. But from what I've seen, you know, the deaths in the village were horrible. I mean, any time a woman loses a child, for example, or a family loses a mother, it's tragic, and there's no way around that. And I certainly learned that when women lose a child, it doesn't matter if you're here in the States or you're there, you've lost your child. And so the child is mourned, and certainly a woman is mourned. But the blame here, I almost feel like we expect the medical establishment to deliver us our perfect baby.
Right.
And if that doesn't happen, man, you are to blame, you know, because we've done everything perfectly. And so then you get into the whole mess of malpractice insurance and that whole thing. So that's where we place the blame here, from my experience. But in Mali, that's not the attitude. There isn't an individual responsibility kind of culture. It's much more sad, and yet it's the will of God.
Yeah.
Something greater is happening here, and we're not to question it. Have you found that, Kim, in the other countries where you've worked?
Yeah, exactly, the will of God. Except I'm thinking, well, it wasn't exactly in the face of childbirth when I remember discovering it, but was when I was in a little thatched roof and some bombs are going off in the background, and I was scared looking at the father, and he was just saying, you know, it's, we're in God's hands, you know, it's just.
Where were you?
In Guatemala at that time. I just remember that sense of, because we're talking about an issue of fear and the unknown, and yeah, there's definitely a look or a deep faith in something higher.
I would like to ask more about Monique. You know, she was, how old did you say she was?
When I met her, she was 24.
And you were?
22.
Uh-huh.
It was quite the contrast.
Yes, tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, here I am in West Africa, right? I'm this white chick from Central Ohio. I'm 22. I'm single. I've spent my entire life avoiding pregnancy at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a self-righteous vegetarian with, you know, I've never done a day's hard labor in my life. And here's Monique, who's 24. She's a midwife for this entire village. She was betrothed to her husband at the age of 5. She'd had three kids by the time I met her, one of whom had already died of malnutrition. You know, she's this totally gleeful meat eater, and she's got these calluses on her hands the size of M&Ms because of the pounding of the millet and all the carrying and the work that she does. So, and then all of a sudden, I'm called to attend this birth with her and realize what I'm seeing and what she's doing, and that I'll do anything just to try to help out.
Mm-hmm.
It was so clear how amazing she was right from the beginning.
Mm, that
it was trial by fire,
portrait.
You know?
Beautiful, beautiful
portrait.
Seeing
that first birth.
Mm. Yeah, what did you, what was it? Tell us something about that.
Well, tell you something about that.
I mean, you must have just... You said, okay, I'm on. I'm going to do this. And this is where I'm supposed to be. And you wanted to help. And then you had talked a little bit earlier about, like, the relationship between, you know, helping and how, in some ways, it changed because of how much Monique helped you.
Mm. Well, and I think at first I was just overwhelmed because if you can imagine, and Kim knows this in the work that she does overseas, it's, you know, 95 degrees, there's no electricity, there's no running water, all the buildings are made of mud, brick. So at night, you know, when Monique called me to this first birth, the sky is immense because there's no artificial light.
Wow.
And yet you're in the middle of nowhere and here these babies are being born and there's no medical backup, there's a lantern for light. And there's the smell of food and of firewood inside the birthing house, and it's all shut up, and so there's bodily fluids, and I was just really overwhelmed by the sensory overload, and yet the miracle of what I was witnessing. Mm-hmm. And so I was more of an observer for the first 6 months and started to read Our Bodies Ourselves just to kind of catch up, you know, learning all these different parts that were important in birth and what I was seeing that was going on, the changes in a woman's body. And then eventually I really understood. I was lucky because Monique had so much already, and she just needed, I was almost like a mirror. Like, she knew that the female genital cutting wasn't helping women give birth.
Right.
She was on birth control herself, the first woman to do so.
Mm.
And so for the first time, she had another woman that could kind of reflect back some of the ideas that she was already having. Birth control is an okay thing to be on. Female genital cutting isn't helping the vagina open up in those early stages of labor. So I fell into that role easily and then could get her more information about other forms of birth control or what have you. So I felt I was really lucky that way.
I would like to continue with this idea of how you were a mirror with Monique. Chris and Kim, let's take a little bit of a music break. Kim, can you tell us, Kim brought the music, is from Mali, right?
Yeah.
Amadou and
Miriam.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break and play some Mali music. Thank you. That was Amadou and
Miriam.
Thank you, Kim. And we're in, this is the Bread and Roses Show on KBOO 90.7. And we are here in Portland, Oregon. Kim Suriano and I'm Marlise. And we are joined by telephone by Chris Holloway, who is all the way over in Holloway, in Massachusetts. Chris, are you still there?
I am still here.
Yay!
And can I just say, I love Amadou and Miriam.
I wanted to ask you about that. Do you know, can you tell us more about
their
music?
They're blind. They're called the Le Couple Aveugle du Mali, or the Blind Couple of Mali. And they are a couple, married couple, Amadou and Miriam. And I think it's Koulibaly, and the last name. And this album is Dimanche à Bamako, or Sundays in Bamako, and it's fabulous, if I can just give them a little plug.
Yes. Have you been there? You were there. You talked about that in your book.
Oh, in Bamako?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. That's the capital.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. The capital of Mali.
Well, thanks, Kim, for bringing this, because she said, oh, this, I got the perfect music. So it is
the
perfect music.
What a great choice.
That is awesome.
I love them.
Oh, well, we'll play some more in a little bit.
Awesome.
You talked about being a mirror for Monique and some of the topics about birth control and genital cutting that you had talked about, and how she would bring these subjects up to you. And there was a point where she was very surprised in the book. Can you talk about that moment when you were talking about genital cutting?
Yeah.
Or maybe
we had attended a birth of a friend of ours, and it was sort of, I was getting more comfortable. I think it was about a year or so into my service, and I was getting more comfortable at births and peered a little more closely than I usually did, and really noticed for the first time that the vagina looked different than I thought it should. It was more scarred and more jagged. And Monique and I had this conversation where I sort of asked about why this woman ripped the way she did. And here I am, right? I'm 23 at this point, and I really don't know what a woman's genitalia should look like in birth, because it really does look completely different even when female genital cutting hasn't gone on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's quite amazing what can, you know, how how it stretches.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned that Korotun, this friend of ours, had been excised. And I had heard about female circumcision, but, you know, when I was in the Peace Corps 15 years ago, it was less well known than it is now. So I had read something about it, but didn't know that much about it. And then Monique and I had this discussion where she basically is explaining it to me and saying, okay, you know, this was Koro's Koloboli, the excision. You know, you remember when you had it done. And I was like, no, I haven't been cut. And she had never met a woman who had not been excised because she thought that everyone had. And why wouldn't she? I mean, we're shocked when we realize women are. And she was shocked when she found out that I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the beautiful thing is we still realize that we had more in common as women and our experiences and our desires than we didn't have in common, you know, sort of getting to that, the things we all share. And so what grew out of that was ordering some materials from a women's group in Bamako that had started to do some education around the practice. So we were able to get tapes in Bambara and French and go through them together.
Mm-hmm. And she went on to show her family the tape, right?
Yeah, she went on. We quickly, you know, I knew right away that it really wasn't my place to go and start talking about this because it's such a sensitive issue. And the women in the village are some of the strongest proponents because it's their daughters and granddaughters' way to get married, way to have children.
Mm-hmm.
And the excisionist typically in the village is an older woman, and it's one of the few positions of power that a village woman has. So she doesn't want to give up that power and that money and prestige. So these women's groups were talking about how to keep the really wonderful cultural aspects of it, of taking girls of the same age out to a place and talking to them about what it's like to become a woman and what to expect. And then it's like a bat mitzvah almost.
Important rite of passage. Yeah,
it's a rite of passage,
lost
exactly.
In our culture.
And boy, could we benefit from some of that here.
Yes.
But then they were trying to just do either a ritualistic nick or no cut at all, just so that the damaging part wasn't done.
Yeah.
And how do men react to that?
Can you say that again?
How do men respond to that?
I didn't talk to men about it. I just, you know, it is such it's such a cultural sort of a hot topic that I never broached the topic with any men, just with women. Though I knew that the fate of Monique's children really lied with her father-in-law, you know, her daughters. But I didn't broach it.
And there was a time that you went to bat for Monique about her wages, and that you did have an opportunity, because I noticed a lot, of course, the book is about your friendship with Monique, that you and Monique, that was your dialogue, and then there were some times when you did have the opportunity to interact at times, for example, with the village chief and talk about Monique's wage and the dynamics of her position as somebody who does have power and work in the village. And could you talk about that when you went to talk to him?
Sure. Monique was in a very unique situation in that she was the first woman in the village to receive a salary. Other villagers in what's called the Association Villageoise, or the official village structure, mostly put in place to weigh the cotton or pay any school teachers. But all of them were men before Monique. And so she was the first person who received a salary, but there wasn't an idea there yet of a woman's work being worth money. So her money would go straight to her father-in-law, even though she was working for it. And he didn't spend it in ways that benefited the health of her children or of the family. So I was immediately outraged.
Right.
As
you could tell.
You can imagine. And, you know, had a conversation where she's like, oh, gosh, you know, just let it rest. Don't bring it up. But then I talked to even men in the village. And even the men in the village said, look, what would normally happen in a situation is Monique would get to keep 50% and her family would keep 50%. And so even in Malian standards, it wasn't quite fair.
Mm-hmm.
So through many, many months, we tried to get Monique her salary and finally did.
Mm-hmm.
Having the boss, so to speak, in a larger town come out and try to explain, and he was a man, try to explain to the villagers how important it was that Monique received her salary herself.
You know, and I thought that was a very beautiful part, too, where he came and actually in front of everyone, that it became, you know, this is the value of working and this is Monique's value. I thought that
It was almost like a griot song, like an honor song that he gave, you know, really talking about just what you said, the value of having Monique there.
But it sounds like it just flowed. Like, after that, it didn't seem like the relationships were strange. Is that correct? Like, even
can you
your relationship?
That?
It sounded like it just kind of flowed in terms of the relationships after that. I mean, it would be... There wasn't like the sense of humiliation on the part of her father-in-law. Obviously, it sounded, what I read is that the village chief, someone was taking a cut at the level of the village, and then the rest was going to her father-in-law, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then after it, sort of this public announcement that this wasn't right, it seemed like people just flowed with it, like they didn't get upset or...
But it still kind of went back and forth a bit. When the village went into debt, they used her salary to help pay off some debt, so she didn't get it for a while. So she was still kind of low end of the totem pole, though she would get it sporadically. And finally, and this isn't in the book because, you know, I had to cut about 100 pages out of the book. But what she ended up doing is getting paid in the larger town of Cuchiala. So rather than the government paying her salage to the village and then the village doling it out, she went straight and picked it up in Cuchiala, thus Cuchiala being the larger town where her boss worked. So thus she actually ended up bypassing the whole village structure.
Mm-hmm. But do you think the father-in-law got upset after that, or their relationship changed?
No, because she still gave him money.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
She still gave him money.
Yeah, because...
I didn't hear that he was upset, and I knew how much he respected Monique, but I don't know, maybe he was, you know? I mean, her husband was certainly always resentful of Monique's status, and... Who wouldn't be? I mean,
right.
She was just outstanding. And the thing that we haven't talked about yet is just how funny she was. I mean, she was so charismatic, and she would, you know, she had like this great arm. There's a scene in the book, you know, where she uses a rock, you know, with greater velocity and accuracy than a Boston pitcher.
Right.
You know, to knock these mangoes down. So she was just surprising and strong in all these ways, and she loved sequins. So she'd always, like, dress in sequins, and she told fart jokes, you know? So she just had such a charismatic personality, and she was so powerful that I think any husband would probably have been a bit envious of how she drew people to her. And in her instance, you know, it was not a match made in heaven, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think he definitely was envious of her.
Yeah, and we were wondering about that, too, when we were talking earlier this afternoon about the dynamics, because you describe Monique, and I can see in her body, I can feel her feet as they walk on the earth, the way you describe her. It's wonderful. And I thought, we talked about, well, maybe he, you know, he seems like he probably really resented her in some ways and felt overshadowed. And then there was the other question of, you know, is there a meaningful work, not only what kind of meaningful work for women, but also men in the village? What other opportunity did he have, or did other people have, a little bit off the subject, of earning a living?
Not a lot. A lot, you know, really cotton is the only cash crop, or In my village, it was. So that everything else is really subsistence farming,
mm-hmm.
maybe making, you know, trying to do some crafts on the side. Mm-hmm. The blacksmiths in the village certainly were probably the wealthiest because of working with metal and being able to fix motors, being able to have the only mill that actually used a generator to grind flour rather than doing it by hand. But there really isn't a lot of opportunities for cash to buy the Western goods that are fortunately or unfortunately so coveted.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the reason why the match was made, most men would not marry a woman who had more education than he mm-hmm. did. So her husband had never been to school, and she had a sixth grade education. But there aren't that many Christians in Mali.
Mm.
I think it varies between 1% and 3%. It's a Muslim nation, and so I think it was their families that knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they did the arranged marriage. I don't
mm-hmm.
know if there was that many sort of people to choose from.
Right, and it was something that everyone did. Can we take another Mali music break with Amadou and Miriam? Is that okay with you, Chris? Let's do it. Let's go, Kim.
Okay.
Can we do another break? Thanks. Thank you to Amadou and Miriam. That was wonderful. Chris, can you tell us about what the song is about or some of the songs are about?
Oh, they're about different festivities in Mali or relationships, days, marriages. That was about a Koulibaly man. So they're not all love songs, which
mm-hmm.
I actually really like. I like it when it's just not about love and heartbreak, you know?
Right, baby, baby, baby.
Yeah, exactly. I miss you so much. I'm not a big country music fan. So, a lot of cultural songs.
Mm-hmm.
I just got back from touring in Ohio and got to do some book readings with a Malian griot, a storyteller. He's the 150th generation of his family.
Oh,
can you believe
that?
Goodness. He knows that. That has been a singer and a storyteller. And it was so wonderful to read sections of the book and then have him talk about, say, birth or death or joy from within his griot tradition with the kora, which is like a Malian guitar. So the music in Mali is interwoven with everything that happens in the culture. Mm. Everyday life, all the markers for the births and the deaths and the holidays, and it's one of those things I miss so much here. So it's great that, Kim, you picked Amadou and Miriam to be on the show with us today.
Nice. Could you read an excerpt from your book, Chris?
I was thinking about is there's a scene in the book. I could do a little birth thing, or the other thing I could do is the scene in the book where Monique has never danced before.
Oh, that was wonderful.
So it's just about a couple minutes. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, we're okay. On for another 13 minutes. So.
All right. So this is a scene. Monique just swore that she could not dance. And even her family said, you know, she just doesn't dance. She has no rhythm. So I'd spent, you know, I love dancing. So I'd spent a good part of my time there really trying to get her to dance, to no avail, until this one night. Night came swiftly, as it always does when the day is not long enough. This is right before I'm going to go, so.
Mm.
My senses seemed acutely aware, trying to absorb all the sights, smells, and sounds of this place, to better remember the paths, the homes, the faces, and the words. Light from the waxing moon shimmered on the straw of the village roofs and washed over the ground. The heavy humidity of weeks past had broken, and the night was remarkably clear. The sky was clean. The rippled grunts of goats and foghorn bellows of cows merged with the murmur of human conversations. From the distance floated a melody of wooden flutes, punctured by an occasional shout. The musicians were gathered in the common to warm up, lightly striking the balafon and sounding the rich tremors of the djembe drum amid the squeals of the young. The flutes grew louder, their sound flying above us like chasing birds. The balafon player ran his fingers through the notes as if they were children at play. Rising clouds of dust from stomping feet filled our nostrils. It seemed as if all of Namposala had emerged for the festivity, young and old, healthy and sickly, women and men. Groups of teens and preteens, dressed in their finest, glowed with anticipation and filled the square between the steps of the Catholic Church and the courtyard of the mosque, not far from the Fetish House. Here, God in all forms kept watch over the energetic children and the relatively sedate adults. I began to dance in place. I walked forward to the rhythm and the crowd formed a space around me. Fatoumata dancing, and my name was Fatoumata when I was there, was always a spectacle. I moved and jumped, waved and grooved. The crowd laughed and hooted, delighted. I looked at the circle and at Monique. I ran and grabbed her hand, pulling her into the melee. The swaying crowd cheered wildly. I heard our names yelled over and over above the quickening beat. Monique tried to pull away but was weakened by laughter. Her headscarf fell as she lowered her head to the ground as if willing her feet to move. And they did. Her long toes splayed, her feet pivoted on their heels, and then she shook. A stirring that extended up to her knees. She stayed bent at the waist, pulling so hard against my grip that should I let go, she would tumble into the rows of onlookers. For a few seconds, the earth felt the tempo of her feet, and then, just as suddenly, they stopped. Monique cackled, let me pull her farther into the fray, stood up with hands raised in the air, and called, "Merci, merci." She had danced in front of the whole village. She had danced. So that's one of my favorite little parts.
Yes. Mm. And she danced for you.
She showed that she was willing to do something that she didn't think she could do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
So,
what a nice present.
Yeah, it was great. And I think, too, and Kim, I don't know if you feel this way, but I read so many horror stories about either Mali or West Africa or Africa in general. And it feels like there's so many grim headlines either about Darfur, Sudan, or about Uganda and the child soldiers, or about HIV/AIDS. And I have such hope for Africa, if I may, because I knew Monique and saw the power of what one woman on a grassroots level can do if given a voice and the right resources. Have you felt that in your work overseas as well?
Well, I think that it's an interesting one where I think from our sort of Western help, we come in with our pomp. I remember in Guatemala in 89, there was the pomp that had been put in 5 years before and then no parts and it doesn't work. And I'm sure you've had that experience where I don't think it works for us to come in and say, okay, this is how it is, and then leave. And then I think you just alluded to it, the true change is going to come from themselves, and maybe us being on the sidelines just cultivating what movement that's come from them within. So I think that's the only way. And yes, there's a lot of hope always.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. And I just had a conversation with a woman who worked in the Peace Corps in my region, and she read the book and emailed me and let me know she's getting a PhD and is doing a qualitative study on the midwives in the region where I was and is working with the midwife in my village of Namposala.
Wow.
And she said, what Monique represented is what I see. She was certainly outstanding, but her story is reflected over and over in these midwives in the villages. And what's the one thing that they want? It's more medical training.
Mm.
Just a little. They have 10 months of medical training, and they're expected to do so much. So it's almost like they've got the support of their communities. They're very wise, and they just want a little more than what they have. And I thought that was really interesting to hear her coming from a dissertation perspective. And here she's asked them what they want, and they've said, and now, well, let's do it. How do we get them what they want?
And it wasn't about more money or, you know, less burden. It's more training
It's more training and more
better
tools
at what they do. Yes. Wow.
Yeah. But it's a fine, I think in Monique's situation, she didn't have that support. Like you said, she was just, I mean, you know, I know what it's like to work, you know, 24 hours straight around the clock. I mean, it's intense, lovely work, but it's hard. And I think she, unfortunately, was probably very overworked. And I think all women, working women, kind of deal with that because you still have the household. And so it's that finding, again, that balance in society, if you will, to have that harmony.
Yeah, it's true. We have that here too, right? Mm-hmm. How do we do work that we love, do work that's important, and take care of the children? Mm-hmm. I mean, we all want the same thing.
It's universal, yeah.
You know, Chris, we have 5 minutes, Chris and Kim. Isn't that crazy how quickly the hour goes?
Well, can't you just extend the show, Marlene?
Yes, exactly. We're not going to... We'll lock the door of the studio here, okay? No one else is getting in. I would like to give you guys each a couple of minutes to, you know, for closing comments, and also to... If you have any information, Chris, of, you know, where to get the book, once again, what the title of the book, your any websites or, excuse me, any contact information that you would like to impart to folks, that would be awesome.
Sure. The book is Monique and the Mango Rains, 2 Years with a Midwife in Mali by Waveland Press, out this past September. It's www.moniquemangorains.com.
Okay.
And my email is attached to that. And one of the special things about the book is I've been able to go on tour, and I have a wonderful publicist that I'm working with because a not-for-profit foundation called the Literary Ventures Fund, it's literaryventuresfund.org, has invested in the book.
Oh.
And they basically, their purpose is to put good books in the hands of readers, books that have the potential for changing lives.
Mm.
And so that's the reason I'm able to go on tour. So I just want to say that for other writers, they are looking for quality works of fiction and poetry and nonfiction. So there's hope for this type of story. I'm not a famous writer, and Monique is not a famous woman, and yet this story is getting out there. And I just feel so grateful, and I want others to know about them as an organization.
And will the book be distributed in schools, or how will they
It's on Amazon.com. It's
okay,
on Barnes
great.
And Noble. You can ask your local independent bookstore for it. They can order it directly from Waveland Press for all the rates that they're used to getting, the percentages. And it will also be available with an instructor's manual for any teachers or professors who adopt it for their classes.
That's fabulous. That is
really fabulous. As you can imagine, it's so wonderful to see this sort of taking off, because the story means so much to me on a personal level.
Mm-hmm. And when will you be going back? We have, I hate to say, but tell us about what your plans are for the future.
My plans are to go back to Mali this summer with my husband and my children, my husband John Bidwell and our kids. And we are going to see this clinic in action that we're raising money for, and see her sister practicing as a midwife, and see her kids. And her brother, Joseph, is going to be installed as a priest, which is a huge honor for her family. So her parents have said, you know, we've never met our white grandchildren, so you better bring them to us now.
Get them over there.
Over there.
They can meet
you
their
got
grandparents.
It. So they're not letting us not bring them over anymore, so we're going to do it.
Well, thank you so much, Chris Holloway. Thank you for joining us from Massachusetts, for having your experience. And thank you.
Yes. Thanks, Marlise. It really felt like, you know, a talk with sisters. What can
it's
I say?
And
we're
it
all,
is.
We're all trying to share these same stories about friendship and the power of what women can do.
Thank you. And thank you, Kim, right here in Portland, for joining us as well. I really appreciate you being here and all your experience. And we're going to have some music now. Thank you for joining us on the Bread and Roses. Off to Amadou and Miriam.
Oh, awa pe jo ni oni ni waju re lati wa seun ri bibibi to je wi pe amo wi pe yo je itewo gba ni waju re awa pe jo ni bayi loni olorun agbalaye ohun gbogbo ta ba se mo sai je ki o ma se amona wa ninu re a fi owo ara ati ohun wa awa si si abe so re nitori pe won nikan en ti o le ran wa lowo wa dari ise wa wa dari orin wa wa dari ohun gbogbo ti a o se je ki ohun gbogbo ti a o se ki o je tewo gba lowo gbogbo araye ki won ki o si le mo wi pe awa fi ohun wa ati ara wa yan ologo edumare olojo oni enikan soso to je pe ohun lo mo ohun gbogbo ti o si le se ohun gbogbo a fi ara wa si abe so re wa pelu wa tori iwo nikan ni alagbala ise amen.